Hello, and welcome to Millennial 2017, number 56. And this is with Professor Mike Isaacson. So, you welcome to the channel, Mike.
How you doing? Great to hear, I guess.
Well, I suppose we should introduce you for people who aren't familiar. You became quite renowned a few months ago for some tweets and so on, and that was you are Antifa. Would that be accurate? Right. Before we go on, how would you define Antifa?
So I guess it's tough because it's less it's not quite an ideological position so much as it is a sort of orientation towards just generally opposing fascism as it operates. And I understand fascism to be kind of a intellectual tradition that goes back to the original fascism and quite a bit before it. There's some pretty good literature that we can talk about if you want. And ultimately, yeah, I see fascism as, first of all, fundamentally flawed in terms of its understanding of sort of social history and social science. I see that normal, say, parliamentary process is not sufficient to stop the threat that it prevents.
So, what is fascism then?
Sorry. So fascism, generally speaking, is kind of predicated on this idea that domination is how the world works. This is largely informed in part by sort of the social system that we're brought up in, namely capitalism, which kind of teaches us this in every way possible, right? You don't succeed unless you are the strongest or hardest worker, according to your boss. If you're a business owner, you need to, make profit by hook or by crook, lest you not maintain an investment stream necessary to compete with your competitors. And we also get this in other sorts of relationships as well, whether it's in, romantic relationships, we're kind of trained that competition is sort of the essence of that as well. And what I see fascism as is kind of taking this social understanding and kind of pushing it to its furthest extreme, saying, yes, this is how the world works, and that we have to transcend the current capitalist state, which kind of prevents the world from being as fully predicated on domination as possible.
Fucking hell.
It's a
Well,
lot.
it certainly is a lot. You see, for me, so you think that the sort of living in a capitalist society filters down the competition that's part of capitalism for sure. You think that that trickles down into people's relationships and they try to dominate each other and what?
So I mean, this is kind of how we have to operate. We're forced to operate in a mode of competition, right? When you're applying for a job, you're competing with the other people that are applying. If you're a business owner, you're in constant competition with like business owners. I mean, we have a system, for instance, heteromonogamy, the family structure that we have currently. That's not how families have always existed. But the kind of legally enshrined kind of compulsory monogamy that we have and the sort of the atomic family, if you will, this is a relatively new phenomenon kind of comorbid with capitalism. That kind of speaks to the sorts of social training that we're expected to sort of undergo. I mean, I would say that the capitalism kind of our social systems filter into how we have to operate in the world, right? And we can't escape the capitalist system.
Yeah, I understand that people are influenced by all sorts of things, and one thing in one sphere will maybe affect their behavior in another sphere. I understand that. I'm just not sure about, how capitalist society. I mean, surely men and women, surely it's quite hardwired the way men and women are. Like, men are mostly dominant and in the bed, in that sphere of life, and women are submissive. I mean, it goes with the biology, doesn't it?
We can talk about a fat life profile if you want, but it doesn't really go with the biology. The biology isn't really hardwired per se. I mean, a lot of it has to do with hormones, which are modifiable. I mean, we've been doing medicine for thousands of years, and at the end of the day, medicine is just body modification be able to exist in the world in the way that you want.
Hold on a minute. We're not evolved for whatever medicine might do to us. We're evolved essentially for an environment that does not have medicine.
We have evolved with medicine. I mean, medicine has been part of human society for thousands of years.
Yes, of course, but I can't imagine that people... Surely you...
You don't think that medicine would impact how we're able to survive in the world?
Of course, but that doesn't mean that it would become integrated into our reproductive psychology, and so that women would be adapted to become dominant, and men would be. It's not like 10,000 years ago they had hormone replacement therapy.
For sure. Unless you're, I guess, Paul Joseph Watson, in which case they had soybeans. So. First of all, the idea that women are naturally submissive is kind of false. There are plenty of societies where women were the breadwinners or chose sexual partners. There's actually quite a bit of interesting anthropological studies on very interesting sexual and romantic practices of various tribes throughout the world.
Were those societies successful? I mean, what I've heard is that matriarchies tend to not last very long.
We also could say that patriarchy might not last very long either.
I don't know about that. I mean, men, women like a dominant man.
What?
Women like dominant men.
Maybe the women you're with, I don't know. But I think people like what they like, and there's no reason to stop them from doing that.
Well, it is a pretty crucial thing, though, isn't it? Because what you're talking about is sort of ignoring natural law and allowing people to explore avenues that might actually do them harm because it goes against their fundamental nature.
If we're assuming survival of the fittest, isn't that how survival of the fittest persists anyway?
Well, yeah, that would mean a radical change in our makeup.
Okay.
But we're talking about tens, hundreds of millions of people here. We could encourage women to be dominant and men to be submissive. That would lead to a change in the gene pool because they wouldn't reproduce because their relationships would be fucked up.
I don't know who we are that's encouraging anyone. I just think people should feel comfortable in their own skin and feel comfortable to do what feels good as long as it doesn't hurt other people.
Well, that's the thing, though, isn't it? Something can be, and on the face of it, I agree with you, but it's more complicated than that, though, because things might be harmful long term. And this is what tradition doesn't come from nowhere. It's accumulated wisdom over many centuries. So things that we might think are harmless because, hey, no one else is getting harmed, actually are harmful to the self over time.
I mean, tradition has also been harmful over long term, too.
Yeah, but that's another matter. That's another matter.
When you say tradition, I mean, what do you mean by that? Because tradition,
the accumulated wisdom of centuries.
But that's like all knowledge, regardless. That is like a compendium of contradictory statements. That is all knowledge is tradition. What human knowledge, I guess, is outside of tradition, I guess, is the question.
What human knowledge is outside of a tradition, that's getting way off base. I'm saying that the reason that these traditions came up in the first place, men are dominant, women are submissive, is because naturally women are submissive and they need to, and men are dominant, most of them. I know that there are outliers, I know that, but it's a fundamental thing. And then if you go against that, it's possible and people can adapt. But it's not good for them.
I did not hear a point of evidence. I just heard tradition is natural because tradition. I don't I'm trying to parse, I guess, where it is that you're pulling the consequences.
You're deconstructing. Yeah.
I'm just asking you to justify your statement beyond the appeal to tradition without really defining what tradition is.
Well, I don't know. You live in New York, don't you? Or New Jersey?
I live outside of New Jersey.
Yeah, I mean, I imagine that's quite a modern urban sort of environment in which people are doing all sorts of experimental things. So yeah. If I ask you, well, in your sphere, how many traditional sort of people do you know, and how many, wacky experimental kind of people do you know? You're going to have quite a biased sample there, I would guess.
I guess, probably. Mm. Relative to you, I guess. I don't know where you live.
Yeah, well, not New York.
I know you were docs, but I actually didn't.
Mm. Well, actually, what I really want to ask you about is, because this is, I mean, this whole thing about men and women, I think we can agree to disagree on that. I think that women are very turned on by dominant men. I think that men are very turned on by dominant women. I just don't think that that's societally induced.
I do. I mean, we're kind of fed that from a very young age. I'm just thinking about, all the Disney movies that I've ever watched, where the men are expected not only to pursue women, but to pursue them very much against their consent. So, for instance, Aladdin, where the dude justifies to himself that it's okay to, pretend that he's a prince in order to, get this woman to sleep with him. Or, Little Mermaid, where this dude is expected to kiss this girl who can't speak in the hopes of, I guess, turning her into a real human and not a fish. We're absolutely trained from a very young age to kind of see this as the form of romance of men pursuing otherwise shy and reluctant women.
I wouldn't say reluctant. I think the word would be coy. Women withhold in order to test men. Men rise to that challenge or not, and succeed or fail.
What challenge did Aladdin rise to? He just wished to be a prince.
I don't know. I haven't seen Aladdin. I'm sorry. I don't know. I think it would be misguided to base everything on cartoon.
I agree, and that's why I don't think that we should be basing the entire social system on the kind of conditioning that we did at a very young age.
Well, it was you who brought Aladdin into the conversation. Right. I'm talking about the way that people actually are in real life.
Right, and you claimed that it wasn't a matter of socialization. I said, yes, it absolutely is, that people transcend the socialization in their later life, but they're very much forced into this mold of a very kind of creepy heteromonogamy.
So would you say that society sort of limits people, and off their own accord, people would be far more open-minded and flexible?
Yeah, I would say society limits people. I think that's part of a function of society, and it's up to the individuals in that society to kind of investigate whether those things are worth preserving. What was the second part of that question? I'm sorry.
And without socialization, people would be more flexible, more open-minded, and would go with their own instincts and all that.
I don't think there's a such thing as without socialization. I think that socialization is extremely important, but also being kind of more scientific about how to administer that socialization is important too, with an eye towards, allowing people to explore, because ultimately that exploration leads to growth.
Are limits good?
To an extent. If we're talking about romantic relationships, limits are definitely good, because some people don't like things, and that should be respected. Limits are important.
Well, okay, here's the thing. There are studies, and this is I want to get onto the issue of identity and race and that kind of thing, identitarianism and the alt-right. So, here's a thing. It looks like, first of all, it looks like the done studies, I'm sure you've heard about them, where a female chimp is given a choice of two toys, the truck or the cuddly animal, and she chooses the cuddly toy. And then the male chimp
is... I've never heard of it done for chimps. I'm just not familiar with these things.
Right. Well, that's one of them. And you know, that's about gender roles being sort of innate. I think I have seen it. I'm sure that the same thing must have been done with human babies.
I've only heard it done with human babies.
So what does that... Well, what do you think about that, first of all?
I mean, I would have to read the study.
But just on the face of it, I mean, if that is...
on the face of it, I'd like to see that study. That's generally how my approach to any sort of scientific knowledge is, having to see the study.
So, of course, you want to be precise and all that, but you don't think that it suggests, perhaps, that, you know, gender roles are innate?
I mean, it would suggest that study demonstrates, perhaps, that it could demonstrate a lot of things, that it is kind of part of the infinite loop of scientific research, right, is that ultimately you're always searching for that exceptional variable or whatever.
Yes, yes, that's true. They're expanding knowledge all the time, yeah. Now, the other one that I wanted to talk about was the thing about human babies choosing, I think it's when they're very, very young, I mean, it's like a few days or a few weeks old, they are naturally drawn to people of their own race, to adults who look like them physically.
Yeah, I'm really not up on that. I feel like I've heard about that. I can't remember where. I mean, I do a lot of research on the far right, so it might very well have been within your spheres. But again, would like to see that study.
Well, I'm sure it can be found, and I'll link you to it afterwards. But I mean, I'm not expecting you to have perfect knowledge of all this stuff, of course not. But the reason I bring that up is it implies, and I know that it's not just been found once, it's not an anomalous result, it's something that's very typical, you know, it makes sense as well. It links up with the Putnam study, but I'm sure you've heard of Robert Putnam's study about diversity.
Remind me, I'm sorry.
He found that diversity stresses people out. Living in a diverse environment makes them more likely to withdraw into their own worlds, because the outside world, the diverse world outside their house, is unpredictable, and they don't know who's in charge. They don't know which group's rules are supreme in that space, and so on. And
this
also
is why I'm an anarchist. This is part of why I'm an anarchist, which is that anarchists are kind of obsessed with structure and very explicit about it. And that's, generally speaking, I operate better in that kind of environment where people are kind of explicit with their needs and their intentions, so as to directly solve that problem of not knowing which kind of cultural variations to follow or whatever.
Well, I mean, it's quite clear what people do when they have the choice. They live with people of their own race. I mean,
if they choose to be non-communicative about their uncomfortableness or whatever.
No, but you can't have every individual communicating his or her needs and desires. I mean, in a social space, obviously there have to be norms and compromises and so on in a public social space. And therefore, it's natural for people to want their group to be supreme in the space where they're living so that they know the score.
Right. And then the question, I guess, ultimately is what constitutes a group in that case. And I think that groups are constantly being created by negotiating those very problems. And generally speaking, I find that communication is a better form of doing that than withdrawing and into, you know, identitarianism perhaps.
So you sort of want a world in which people just cooperate and negotiate and mix together. Yeah, that sounds good. Well, okay. Well, I mean, I would say that would result in the end, possibly either with one group just dominating the others for being weak, or they would all just mix into nothingness, and then there wouldn't be any groups anymore. There wouldn't be any diversity anymore.
I mean, it would certainly mean that there would be a change in both groups or in all groups, whatever. But again, I mean, ultimately, it's about negotiating those terms so as to leave the most room for uniqueness within it.
Well, see, what I would say is, before the age that we're in now, each group had basically had its own territory. If we're speaking about racial groups or ethnic groups, they originated, they evolved in specific regions which were solely theirs. And so that was a simple scenario. Oh, yes, but after tens of thousands of years, I mean, everyone knows...
There was plenty of migration. There was plenty of migration throughout human history, over really long distances, too. I mean, the Silk Road existed for thousands of years. And I mean, that kind of sort of nationalistic version of national separatism or whatever didn't really emerge, until, around the time of the slave trade, particularly the end of the slave trade when, scientific racism was used to maintain kind of the institutional differences that had arisen, between various racial groups.
Oh, well, that's another matter entirely. I didn't actually want to get onto racial differences, but I imagine we would certainly disagree on that. What I would rather talk to you about is simply the existence of groups. You see, what I wanted to ask you about, I wanted to ask about identitarianism today and the alt-right. So, well, what do you think about the alt-right, as you've found it today?
Well, I watched the alt-right grow from kind of a smallish phenomenon. So I don't know how familiar you are with my biography, but basically, I started getting into, being interested in kind of, fascism, as it manifests today, around 2011, 2012. I organized a counter rally, to the, Aryan Nations, marching in Washington, D.C., which is a Christian nationalist, white nationalist group. From there, I kind of kept paying attention to the far right, and this alt-right thing kept coming up. In 2014, it became kind of a bigger thing, with Richard Spencer, I think that was when he started, doing an NPI conference every year. He had previously done every other year. So I've watched it kind of grow. What seems to be Richard Spencer's initial strategy with it, so he was the one that coined the term. The initial strategy seemed to be to unite various disparate factions of the kind of outside of the mainstream right, along the line of eugenics. And when I say eugenics, I mean in the broad sense, that encompasses not only kind of biological race theory, but also biological gender theory. And also biological class theory. And this kind of merged the kind of three disparate factions, namely the kind of state-oriented kind of ethno-nationalists, the paleoconservatives who are more oriented against immigration, the kind of the men's rights activists, the tribalists. All three of those groups usually don't agree because of their various positions on, say, the state or whatever, but they managed to find common ground in kind of this scientific understanding of the world, one that I think that you've been expressing in reaction to me. So the alt-right seemed to have kind of its ascendancy, 2015 when Donald Trump first started running for office, really made a name for itself with Hillary's stupid speech.
Just before you get into that, could you tell me what you said, biological gender theory? What is that?
Yeah, so this is... the theory basically that, like you were saying earlier, that gender and sex are intimately connected, that they're inseparable, that that gender is an expression of kind of natural biological processes rather than being an expression of how society tells us to gender effectively.
Does that not sound likely to you?
I mean, there are, like I said, there are plenty of societies that have genders outside of our kind of binary gender spectrum, and they're expressed in different ways. I mean, even European societies have had gender expressed in multiple ways. I mean, you look at the paintings of like Renaissance era royalty, right? If they were to walk around today, they would be made fun of for being like pansies or whatever. So I mean, like the way that gender is expressed has changed throughout history, and there's no reason to believe that it can't continue to do that.
Has it been largely a consistent thing that in the various expressions of gender in European history that men have been dominant and women have been submissive, for example?
I mean, I'm not entirely sure. I don't imagine. Just because it's so inconsistent everywhere else, I would be very surprised if Europe were unique in that.
Hmm. Okay. So we're talking about the alt-right.
Hmm. Yeah, so got its kind of peak in 2016. We shut down the dinner of the conference that you spoke at. I was not part of the planning of that, but I was there for the Maggiano's dinner shut down, where Richard Spencer got what I believe someone called ass juice sprayed on him. were you there for that, for the night, the dinner before?
Yes, I was. I didn't see you in the crowd. I was filming them, though.
Oh, yeah. I was kind of farther down the stairs, yeah. You could probably find me if you go back to your film. But yeah, like I said, I wasn't really part of planning that. I had planned what ended up being a smaller resistance thing.
So, actually, on that note, obviously, yeah. You think that you have the right to shut down events by your political opponents, private events.
Well, fascists specifically, yes.
So, how would you feel about fascists shutting down your events?
When they've done it.
And do you think that's okay?
No, that's why we try to oppose them.
Sorry?
Said no, that's why we try to oppose them.
So they shut down your events, so you shut down their events.
And we also try to prevent them from putting on events.
You try to prevent them from putting on events. But don't you think that that's... you know, sort of fascist in itself?
No.
Why not?
Well, so the thing is about how fascism organizes. So fascism is, like I've kind of been hinting at, is top-down, hierarchical. Anarchist organizing, communist organizing is not that way. Certain Marxist-Leninist parties leave a bit to be desired in that regard, but anarchist organizing is certainly not that way, and anti-fascist organizing is definitely not that way.
This is another issue. I was going to the NPI conference last year to give a speech about atomization, right? Mm-hmm. And presumably, if you could, you would have prevented that speech from being given.
Probably.
Yeah, have you watched the speech?
No. I haven't watched you speak, unfortunately. The only thing I've watched of you is the video of, the video of you talking about me for 47 minutes. That was really strange.
Sorry, which video did you watch?
The one of you, the Ballad of Mike Isaacson. The one that you...
Oh, right. Yes. Okay. Yeah.
One.
Well, yes. It was certainly a strange experience when you contacted me about it. But I'm interested in this because the speech I gave was designed to help people and to give them a context in the world that they're living in, and to give them meaning in their lives, because I think a lot of young people today don't have meaning in their lives. So,
sure.
No, but hold on a minute. You've said that you would try to stop me from giving that speech.
Yeah, so, I mean, fascism, or nationalism, or whatever you want to call it, identitarianism. It ultimately serves to do that. There are plenty of things in the world that serve to do that. You know, religion serves to do that. But at the end of the day, I don't believe that all is equally valid just because it's being said and because it's...
Oh, right, so you disagree with my... Hold on, you disagree with my views, so you think they're less valid of being heard?
I think that your views aim to actively do harm, so they... should not be heard yet. Or they should not be given public space.
Really? Well, I would say that my views and my work, I'm trying to help people. I'm trying to help mostly white people, but also other people of other ethnicities to find themselves. So who are you to decide should be allowed?
Talk to me about how you see it as helping people.
Because I'm giving them a sense of themselves in history, a sense of where they of what they belong to, which is an ethnic group, among other things.
Those ethnic groups change over time. Like, they're not historically
Don't give me that bollocks. Don't give me that bollocks.
No, I'm serious.
No. You're talking rubbish. The ethnic groups last for centuries, thousands of years, tens of thousands of years. So don't give me the bollocks that, because it didn't exist 10,000 years ago, therefore no one can be a member of it. That's just sophistry.
No, I'm saying ethnic groups change and transform all the time.
Not all the time. It's a very slow process. It's a very slow process. And also, I shouldn't have to defend my views to you to prevent you from trying to shut them down, right? That's what you're doing here. You're trying to put my views on trial so that you can then justify saying, well, I don't think you should be allowed to give that speech in public. Who the fuck do you think you are?
No, I'm saying that...
Yes, that's exactly what you're doing. You said that my views are valid of being heard in public.
I'm saying the conclusion of your views is genocide.
No, it is not. And also, even if it were, that would not give you the right to shut it down.
Okay. Well, I mean, like,
According to morality, according to your sense of morality, according to anyone's, who the fuck do you think you are to decide, well, millennial woes, his views lead to genocide? First of all, they don't. And second, even if they did, that would not give you the right to, by force, stop me from giving a speech. Who are you to decide what everyone else should be allowed to hear?
So, you're not giving a speech. You're giving a speech in a building that is under the control of not white nationalists who have every right to shut you down. The building that you ultimately gave that speech in was a government building.
If it were a private building, would you have left it alone?
Probably not. I probably would have gotten the owners to shut it down.
So the type of building is utterly irrelevant. So, another thing I want to bring into this, because you said that my idea is to genocide. No, you're just flailing around here talking about the building. It really doesn't matter, and you know it doesn't matter. The other thing I want to bring in, you said that my views lead to genocide. I think that your views lead to the end of my people, of white people, and in the case of Britain, of British people. So why should I not be allowed to defend my people? And why is it some kind of outrage for me to do that?
Why do you think that your views lead to the end of your people?
Because you're encouraging, first of all, the view that my ethnic group isn't really a thing. And second, that it should be mixed out of existence anyway.
I mean, what makes it a thing? are you saying that you're British? Is that...
Yes.
Okay. Why aren't you a Scottish nationalist? I don't understand. Aren't you Scottish?
Yes, I was born in Scotland and grew up there, yes.
Okay. So, I mean, why reunite with the Empire?
The Scots had a pivotal role in the Empire.
Okay.
But in any case, being British...
What was your position on the Scottish referendum?
That was 2014. That was 3 years ago. And I voted against independence back then. I don't know what I would vote now.
What would you vote now?
I don't know.
I mean, it's still on the table, so it's not like it's an irrelevant issue.
It is not. It probably will. I think there will be another referendum, but that's another matter. I can see myself as both Scottish and British, so there's not a dichotomy there.
Okay, so I guess what makes you think that Britain should be ethnically unique, but Scotland not so much?
Ethnically unique?
I guess what attaches you to Britain, how do you want Britain's national identity or whatever to be expressed?
I think it's not a matter of values or culture so much. I think it's those things arise naturally.
Okay.
Excuse me, from the gene pool of the people who've been there for thousands of years.
Okay. So what determines being part of that gene pool?
Having those genes.
All right. So when you say having those genes, are like, are you getting tested for this or what?
Yes, I actually have done 23andMe, yes.
Okay, so what happens if someone doesn't, you know, meet those criteria?
I don't know. I'm sorry?
Are they welcome in Britain?
It would depend. It would depend on the circumstances, their various percentages, whether they were going to have kids, how culturally destructive they could be, and so on.
So, if they were not genetically British, if we're to say such a thing exists,
Hold on a minute. Such a thing does exist. My ethnic group does exist. So, don't say that again.
Okay. What are the consequences of not having British genes?
Where they fit in better. I mean, for example, I know something like a Pakistani has Pakistan, and it is full of Pakistanis, and I think he should live there.
Do you think all Pakistanis are equally welcome in Pakistan?
It's not my problem.
Do you know how many ethnic groups there are in Pakistan?
I don't, it doesn't matter to me.
It matters to them.
Well, that's their problem, isn't it? I mean, we gave them that country.
You're the one saying that I should give a shit about British identity or whatever.
I'm not saying that you should give a shit about it. I'm saying that you should not try to destroy it or deny it.
I mean, you just...
No, I didn't. No, you're saying that that's a contradiction. It's not. You are actively denying that there is such a thing as the British people or the English people or the Scottish people. I am not denying that there's such a thing as the Pakistani people, or that then breaks down into subgroups. It's not my issue. It's not my expertise. That's their situation.
So I guess what is it that makes an ethnic group versus just like the rest of the world? I guess why Britain versus like, say, all of Europe or Eurasia or something?
I think that's largely a matter of human judgment and perception, but it's very consistent. Anyone who looks at me would know that I'm not a Somalian, for example, or you, for that matter.
Probably.
Yeah. I mean, they would know that you weren't Chinese.
Probably. And it could be Chinese, but not Chinese. There were Chinese Jews. You ever heard of Chinese Jews?
I've heard of Chinese Jews, yes. Oh, that's another thing. I mean, I didn't know that you identified as a Jew. Is that part of your identity?
Well, yeah, I mean, yeah, it's something that's been imposed on me, so, yeah. I don't know. It is what it is. Can't escape it.
You can't escape it.
Mm-hmm.
You can't just choose to be something else or to define yourself in some other way.
Correct. Society does that for you.
Well, society or DNA, perhaps?
I mean, there are genetic markers. They're not very important. Generally speaking, they survive by virtue of not having much impact on the human genome. Like, that's why they're able to survive. If they did, they would.
So what is the, which specific type of Jew are you? Is it Ashkenazi or?
Ashkenazi. So as I understand it, I have family who came over from Russia and I believe Romania to the United States sometime in the early 1900s.
Right. And do you feel part of the American mainstream?
I mean, no, but mostly because of my political views. what do you mean, I guess, in terms of?
Well, you strike me as someone who's very much an outsider to the society that he finds himself in and so is trying to deconstruct it.
I don't know if that's the motivation for wanting to deconstruct it, or if I would call what I do deconstruction. But yeah, I don't know. I'm not sure what your point is here.
I'm just wondering if the identity that you have is something that's solid, inescapable, as you said, and therefore that identity sort of is hardwired.
No, I mean, I can cultivate it if I wanted, right? I could wear a yarmulke if I wanted. I could actually, like, be a practicing Jew instead of, like, the heathen that I am.
A secular Jew.
Sorry. I shouldn't have said heathen. That's disrespectful. But, yeah.
The reason I ask is there is obviously a cliche of Jews who don't feel at one with the countries that they are in.
The wandering Jew and all that. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. So they are sort of bound to deconstruct it.
Yeah, no. I mean, I'm familiar with that Kevin McDonald stuff. No.
But that seems to be exactly what you're doing.
No.
You asked if you said that my ethnic group doesn't even exist.
No, I said it didn't matter. At least not to the extent that you think it matters. Because ultimately, like I said, ethnic groups change all the time.
But your Jewish identity obviously matters to you. It's obviously a part of you.
I mean, some of the stories are fun. Some of the stories are weird. Some of the stories are a problem. I mean, it's not like I am uncritically Jewish. There are very much things that I have a problem with within my community. I have a huge problem with the existence of the state of Israel, for instance.
You're an anti-Zionist.
Yeah, got some weird politics around that, but yeah, in total, I guess, yeah.
That's interesting. Why is that? Why are you against Israel?
Well, I mean, primarily because I'm an anarchist, so like I'm against all states.
I imagine the Jews in Israel wouldn't like you very much.
There are anarchist Jews, anti-Zionist Jews in Israel, who grew up there and that's the country they know. Also, I don't like ethno-states in particular. I think the Palestinian people deserve the right to happiness of a life, a fulfilling life, free of persecution.
Yeah, it's too bad for the Palestinians, really. I mean, I have no position on this one way or the other. It's not my problem, really.
It's so easy to say. But, like, at the end of the day, like, the fact that the Palestinians are in captivity means that, like, your government is financing Israel to keep them that way so that they can, like...
Oh, well, I'd rather we did...
So that your weapons industry can make money, you know? I mean, this is how the system operates, right?
We expect us to
turn a blind eye towards other people's problems.
Yeah, like, honestly, like, hold on a minute.
Problems benefit...
Well, wait a minute. Class. I mean, you and I are in agreement here, right? I don't want us to be sending any money to Israel. I think with their high IQ, they should be able to deal with this themselves and make money and all the rest of it. So I don't think there is a need for us to be sending aid money to them. I agree with you. So I don't like being implicated or my people being implicated in these things.
It's not about implicating your people. This is what I'm trying to get the point across with. It's that your people are actively harmed. Right, because your people are ultimately in a position, and when I say your people, I mean working class people.
No, I'm not working class, but anyway, go on.
But anyway, the common people of Britain, if you will, they are ultimately at the mercy of those who rule them. You know, of the politicians who are in the pockets of big financiers and big executives, and those people ultimately profit from the continued bondage of the Palestinian people. That the British weapons industry makes money by virtue of this foreign aid going to Israel and then coming back in the form of weapons purchase, right? In the United States, even more so. I mean, the United States is a huge funder of not only Israel but also of Egypt and. And there's other countries doing this exact same thing.
I must say, I'm delighted that we've found something that we can agree on, Mike. This is really nice. I totally share your views on this.
Right. So the point is that ultimately the issue is not a matter of ethnicity or nationality. The issue is it's a matter of the fact that we have a social system, an economic system that perpetuates this kind of continued decimation of anyone who isn't of the owning class.
Or you could say it's to do with, you know, rich Jews.
No, it's rich like Goyim too.
Goyim.
Sure, yeah. Yes, if that is the word I use. It is an easy way to say non-Jew. That was a Christmas present, I guess. I don't know. But yeah, I mean, ultimately, it benefits the executives of GE. It benefits the executives of Raytheon, Northrop Grumman, all the weapons companies, which are by and large not owned by Jews.
Okay, so you see Israel as an ethnostate.
Unfortunately, yes.
And would you rather that Jews lived as a diaspora, you know, in other people's countries throughout the world?
I'm really big on diaspora. I'm really big on the diaspora. Yeah, I think people should be comfortable wherever they are. I don't think that they should have to fear for their safety. I think they should be able to find a welcoming community wherever they live in the world.
Well, that would be nice. That would be nice. But of course, doing that ultimately would lead to the lack of ownership of any territory by any people, wouldn't it?
I mean, how do you collectively own land as a people? I mean, apart from states, which again, anarchists do.
I think that that's something that is sorted out. It just sorts itself out. I mean, people own land. I mean, presumably you're against the Native Americans losing America back in the day.
They didn't
have a state.
Some of them did. The United States Constitution is actually kind of based off of Native American law, oddly enough. The Iroquois Confederacy, in particular. Pretty interesting.
The Native Americans had a state.
They had several confederacies. Yeah.
Right. Okay. Fair enough. Okay. Bad example then. Nonetheless, I think that to say that the only
I wouldn't call it a state in like the modern sense, where it has like a top down government, not like that. But they had a confederacy of kind of agreements and treaties,
tribes and stuff. Right. Okay. Well. Okay. Yeah. Fine. I think the question here is that the reason that came up is you said that a people, a group, cannot own land without there being a state.
Right. Well, if we're talking about a nationality or an ethnicity or whatever, yes, that's the case. Yeah.
You see, what this seems to point to is that you are a diaspora Jew, and you are safest, and all diaspora, indeed all wandering people, are safest if the people they live amongst don't have solidarity, they don't have a self-image of themselves as a group.
No, I mean we're safest when that self-image is an exclusionary. You know, when that self-image
it has to be exclusionary, though, doesn't it? Yes, it does. I mean, what is a club if anyone can be a member of it?
No, it's what is a club if anybody? I don't know. Like it's. I feel like you can have a welcoming culture. You know, you can have Oktoberfest and everybody be welcome.
Yeah, but then it can become sort of meaningless, though, isn't it? Can't it? I mean, if it's just something that anyone can do, then, you know, I mean, I've been to Germany and Oktoberfest is their thing. It's not my thing. Even if I take part in it, it's still not my thing. It's, but it's not the thing.
The point is, though, that you're welcome, right? You're welcome to participate in it. If you get in with that community or whatever, they might allow you to participate in it in some capacity, whatever. But the point is that culture identity doesn't have to be hostile.
Of course, it doesn't have to be hostile. I certainly agree with you on that. But it's a matter of good fences make good neighbors, isn't it? I mean, people want stability. I know you're an anarchist, so maybe that just goes totally against you.
No, actually, I'm actually super about stability. And part of what I believe is that stability comes from actively communicating and negotiating with people so that everybody is able to ensure that their best interests are being served. I am a huge proponent of harm reduction. I think that material harm, as best as we can, should be reduced. That's kind of part of the unfortunately public side of anti-fascism, whereas the private stuff of like petitioning, canvassing neighborhoods, building like community events, whatever, I mean, that kind of goes flies under the radar or whatever. But I mean, that's kind
of it certainly does. I mean, I think most people's image of anti-fa is of, you know, violent mobs.
Right, and that's unfortunate. I mean, I wrote an article actually. And here we go again, for a magazine called Jewish Currents, called Can Anti-Fascist Activities That Don't Involve Your Fists, which is about this other work. I mean, ultimately, it is about building solidarity with community. If you're not doing that, you're just going to punch a Nazi in the face, and that doesn't really do anybody any good. To my mind, the most important work is that work of kind of building a society where everyone fits.
So if you met me, would you punch me? And presumably you see me as a Nazi.
I mean, so this is the other thing, is that like there's not, it's more of like a social milieu or a political milieu than it is like a hard and fast definition when it comes to fascism and Nazism. So you identify as an identitarian, I respect that, whatever. I would say that you're in that kind of sphere that Nazis also find themselves, and I'm sure that 2016 NPI conference made you pretty aware of that.
About four people in the audience, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. yeah, not everybody is, you know, the best at a public event. But yeah, I don't know. I wouldn't, because that's not the work that I do. Like, I am not a very strong person.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't make sense for me to engage in that.
But what if somebody else, one of your colleagues, punched me? Would you congratulate them or what?
No, maybe. And like I said, I don't think that it's... I don't know. Like, to me, like Richard Spencer getting punched in the face on video, that was huge. That was important because like that is a kind of social symbol. That very much communicates sort of what it is, right? I mean, Richard Spencer was pretty high profile at that point, and that definitely took him down a peg. You, although you have quite a bit of a following, are not nearly as well known outside of kind of far right spheres. And so you getting punched in the face, even off on video, I don't think that would make much of a difference to most people.
So really it's a matter of, if it's profitable,
sure,
then do it.
Well, so it's a matter of strategy. I mean, ultimately, any sort of political activism on any stage, but whatever your ideology is, right, is ultimately going to be a matter of strategizing and trying to figure out how you're going to spread your message and how you're going to interface with the public.
Well, I mean, after hold on a second, because after that controversy a few months ago, you're quite well known. So how about if some Nazi punched you?
That would be probably unfortunate for me.
Yeah, it would, wouldn't it?
Yeah. I don't know. Should happen.
Oh my god.
What?
I don't know. Maybe,
I mean, are you telling me that you proceed in the work that you do without a perception of like the risk that you are taking on? Like you have to know that you are not you're aiming to be not popular with the public, right?
I'm not aiming to be unpopular with the public.
Okay, well, regardless, like you don't perceive like the risk of the work that you do.
Yeah, but I that doesn't mean that I think it's a good idea to punch people who are, you know, just in public like that. I mean, I wouldn't punch if I saw an Antifa guy in front of me, on his own, vulnerable, and he was quite high profile and all that, I wouldn't think, oh, I'll go and punch him. It just wouldn't even occur to me to do that.
Well, I mean, I guess it does to us. I don't know what you want me to tell you.
See, I don't know. I mean, I'm involved in the alt-right and identitarian sort of stuff, right. And nobody talks about punching Antifa just like that, like in the way that Richard Spencer was punched. Like, just, oh yeah, find him when he's unawares, catch him unawares, go and punch him, and then run away.
I guess you don't frequent the Discord chats then much, because they definitely talk about it there.
I don't know who that would be. I mean, presumably that's 4chan Spergs, but has it actually happened?
No, I mean, there's like the Discord chats from the Charlottesville organizing relief, and it was all that.
Well, at Charlottesville, you want to talk about Charlottesville, the violence was started by Antifa there.
No, like, y'all had people hiding weapons throughout the city.
Yeah, because they were expecting violence from Antifa.
Okay.
Because Antifa had shown themselves to be violent in rallies in recent history at that point. So that's why, I mean, I agree with you, it's not a good look for those, the Unite the Right people, to be there with baseball bats and masks, but they were doing that because they knew that without it, they'd be vulnerable.
I mean, the thing is that you're asking anti-fascists to give fascism the benefit of the doubt every time.
I'm asking not to be violent towards us in public. I mean, it just seems a small ask.
The politics, like, is predicated on that.
On violence and force.
Yes, yes.
The very thing that you were saying you're against.
The very thing that I am trying to minimize, yes.
Right.
I mean, like, at the other day, like, we have a social system that's maintained by violence anyway. Like, you can't have a state without violence. You can't have property without violence. Like, I don't know, like, why you got your fingers in the twist about violence. Violence exists. Violence is something that happens. Violence is something that, like, ultimately society needs to figure out how it controls. And I don't think of the fascist, or identitarian, whatever, method of wielding violence as a good one. So anti-fascists.
Well, it's not so much about the violence that they're wielding, it's the type of society that they want to build.
Right, which, again, is ultimately predicated on violence, but we can't.
But surely your type of society would also be predicated on huge amounts of violence.
It would be predicated on democratically decided upon violence instead of top-down, envy-based violence, yes.
So everyone's fate is just put to a popular vote?
Not about vote. It would be more consensus-based processes. So basically, if you're personally harmed, like... Oh my god. Yeah. Sorry.
It's okay. So it does seem that, you know, if we look at the history...
I need to wrap this up. I actually do have to go somewhere.
All right, okay. Well, just one last thing then. The history of communism is the history of mass violence, isn't it? I mean, the history of tens of millions. Yeah, but communism...
The history of most states is the history of mass violence.
Yeah, but communism is 100 million in the last century.
You can look at the history of Britain, and it's also pretty substantial.
If you're even going to go there, then the end result was a stable, functioning, highly prosperous society, whereas the result of communism was just mass misery and starvation.
I mean, I don't think that Bangladeshi people would agree with you on that.
The Bangladeshi people?
Yeah, no, the ones that were genocided by Winston Churchill during the Second World War.
No, they weren't. As soon as he heard about what was going on, and I'm not even a fan of Winston Churchill, but as soon as he heard about what was going on, That was a logistical error in the middle of the war effort.
Yeah, that's I hear Tanky say the same thing about Stalin's involvement in Ukraine too.
But the Holodomor.
You know, it's the same thing that those shitty Stalinists say about Stalin. So I really don't think there's any. I don't know, not a big fan of states.
Not at all. So, you know, just to end then, I guess, you don't recognize the importance of ethnic groups?
Apart from like being able to play with culture, like.
So would you say that if somebody does care about their ethnic group and their race, in the American context, white Americans, for example, if somebody does care about that and they want their race to survive, they are your opponent?
No. So like this idea of like a race surviving is kind of fraught with issue. So first of all, ethnic groups and races are different. Races aren't really a thing.
Do you believe in white privilege?
Actually, the theory of white privilege kind of annoys me, to be honest, because I think it obfuscates away from systems of oppression, which are very much material. I don't think it's simply a matter of people having white skin or whatever that gives them an advantage. I think it is systems that have been legally implemented.
The reason I asked about white privilege was it tends to be leveled at white people, the accusation that you have white privilege. So therefore, in order to level that accusation at them, you have to perceive them as white. And therefore, we all agree that there is such a thing as white Americans.
Sure. So this is, again, the issue of social constructs versus, like, nature, right? So the fact is that whiteness is something that was created legally so as to maintain a caste system, particularly in the United States, but also elsewhere. So yeah, whiteness exists by virtue of having been imposed by legal systems that enforce inequality.
So what is whiteness then? What is whiteness? Just a sort of system of oppression?
So I mean, it's kind of evolved from that, given like kind of its... the fact that it's like been so long to me, the people that say that there's no such thing as white culture, I don't think that's very helpful, because cultures happen all the time. And I think there sort of has kind of become a white culture that has emerged from, the various sorts of life ways that white people enjoy. And I don't think all of white culture is worth decimating. I think plenty of it's worth like preserving. And I mean, there's plenty of aesthetic stuff that white people have done that I think is great, you know.
Philosophy and art and
Exactly. I think it's worth celebrating. But I think white culture, whiteness, like I mean any sort of ethnic group, I think, needs to consider the ways that they operate in the world, right? And how they relate to the world. And to me, my general moral stance is one where people should endeavor to reduce the harm they cause.
And just like one last thing then, I'm guessing that as a Jew, you don't feel like a white American as such.
It's provisional. I like to call it provisional whiteness.
Provisional whiteness?
Because ultimately, like, these things are a matter of social perception, right? I mean, I'm perceived as white in certain social scenarios that I'm not in others, right? At NPI, if I had announced myself as Jewish, I would not be seen as white by most people there. If I went to Howard University's campus, right, and I told people that I was Jewish, they would still perceive me as white, right? And ultimately, like, that... it's not a matter of what I truly am. It's a matter of kind of how my body is perceived in the world, and what that means for how people interact with me, right? If I go to a job interview as a white man, I'm more likely to get a job. This is verified by what are known as audit studies. I am more likely to get a job than a black man of the same qualification in this country. And that's not because I am superior by virtue of having my understanding. It's because the interviewers have whatever preconceptions they have.
No, I imagine in many areas that you'd be more likely to get a job if you emphasized your Jewishness as well.
I think there might be some, at like Jewish community centers or something like that, where like it would be relevant.
The media.
No.
Well, we can agree to disagree on that. And I don't know, you've presumably seen the infographic of CNN.
Yeah, I've seen an inaccurate infographic. They're very selective in who they choose to put on those things. I mean, those things have been around for years. Like, they constantly change, but they're always the same, which is they just pick whatever executives do it and put them on.
God, there must be loads of executives, if you know, enough to outweigh all of those Jewish ones. And that's, I don't know.
And this is another thing too. Again, with the issue of, I guess, white privilege or whatever, the fact that we have, you know, institutional barriers to people who do not have light, lighter skin, they generally don't ascend to the ranks of executive.
Well, yeah, but I mean, there are all sorts of reasons for that. I mean, to do with IQ levels, averages, you know. That kind of thing, but I'm guessing you would dispute the idea that Black Americans are less intelligent than White Americans.
Well, I would dispute the idea of linearly measurable intelligence, and the idea of innate intelligence. So intelligence is something that is largely socially constructed. It's a result of like us deciding what is important. In terms of what we need to know in society, and those things are ultimately taught, right? So if you are brought up, and this is, I don't know if that, how it is in Britain, but in the United States, the school system is largely funded by local profit taxes. So where you have higher income people, which typically are whiter, the historical segregation, you will have better school systems. And as a result, you will have a population that is better educated and hence will perform better on IQ tests. Whereas if you are in a poor neighborhood, you will have a worse school system and hence your outcomes for education will be lower. So while statistically there probably are correlations, those correlations are largely explained by differences in education.
You should look up the Minnesota Transracial Adoption Study. It's about twins who were reared apart. It's very interesting.
There's also a wealth of scholarly work that I have that disputes it. So, I have an entire folder on eugenics. It's great.
Mm. Well, it certainly worked for the Jews, though, didn't it? I mean, eugenics got them an average IQ of, was that 115 or something?
So sort of.
Come on.
I'm familiar with this. I'm familiar with this talking point. I really haven't researched it fully enough to see if it's actually true. But again, even if it is, like, intelligence by virtue of the educational situation that we put people in, and those situations are usually differentiated by virtue of institutions of oppression.
Mm. So you very much believe in culture and socialization, and very little is innate.
I believe that education is a thing that works.
Oh, yeah, well,
people learn from better education.
Yeah, like, yeah.
If you have more resources for education, then that education will probably result in better outcomes on average.
Mm. Okay, well, I guess I don't really have any other questions for you. It's been a very interesting discussion.
Thank you so much.
Yes, I hope that if we ever do meet, you don't punch me. I'll try not to punch you.
I've been known to shake y'all's hands before. I think I shook at the 2015 NPI conference. I shook Roman Bernard's hand, introduced myself, and all the color drained from his face. It was great to watch.
Was he scared of you?
Well, he just knew who I was because I was organizing against that conference.
Oh, I see. I see. I wasn't present there.
Right, this was the year before, I think.
Mm. Well, I suppose I should just end it because I don't have any other questions. Yeah. But it is interesting. I think, just my own conclusionary thoughts, I think you very much display stereotypical traits of a diaspora Jew who doesn't want to feel in danger or threatened by the host population. That seems, I mean, I know you don't want to be, I can tell that you're a thinking machine and all that, but it seems that consciously or not, you are acting out that stereotype.
I think that's a comforting thought for you. Because the alternative, right? The alternative is that you cash in all your chips on this video career on something that is very incorrect.
You've disputed innate intelligence, innate IQ levels, ethnic groups. Basically,
this is largely in accord with the dominant literature in social science and biological science,
which is largely dominated by Ashkenazi Jews.
You could say that's not true. Largely dominated by white men.
All right. Okay. Well, let's leave it at that. And
all right.
Okay, it's been an interesting discussion. Thank you for coming on. And okay, that was Professor Mike Isaacson. Sorry?
Merry Christmas. Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas to you too. Thank you. Okay, so that was Professor Mike Isaacson. And okay, that was millennial number 56, I believe. And I've got another one coming up in about half an hour. So there we go. He's left. I was hoping for a chat afterwards. Oh, well. Strange experience. Pretty sure I was right about him, though. All right. Bye-bye.